Hi, this is Paul McCusker, and welcome to the unofficial Adventures in Odyssey podcast, which means I'm not officially here, and any answers I give you are not official, so you can't believe a single word I'm about to say.
Hi, this is Chris.
And Sarah.
We're just getting ready for a time of amazement.
Surprise.
And good times.
Welcome to the unofficial Adventures in Odyssey podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 58 of the unofficial Adventures in Odyssey podcast. Today we're very, very excited to announce that Darien's Rise is out! So, Sarah, what do we have lined up for today?
Well, today we have a very special guest with us. We have author, director, and executive producer Paul McCusker with us from Adventures in Odyssey. Yay!
Hi guys.
Hey Paul, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, good to be with you again.
All right. Well, I think we're going to jump right into it, and we're going to start with questions about the early days of Adventures in Odyssey. And I want to know, how and when did you decide you wanted to do writing as a career?
Well, I'd always loved writing and had started writing when I was, 4 or 5 years old. But I don't know that I actually believed that I'd be a writer in the sense of a creative writer until probably when I started working with Odyssey, because prior to that, I would write as a freelancer, and I would do a lot of stuff for my church and church dramas. But anybody who knows that field knows that it doesn't pay very well, not enough to make it a career. So I wound up doing that, and then I was working as a copywriter for a publishing house. So that's sort of my tent making while I was doing this other stuff on the side. So it wasn't really until I was hired to do Odyssey that everything converged so that I was actually making a living as a writer.
Now, what was the first book that you wrote, and was it ever published?
First book was, yeah, it was actually. I did a collection of sketches that I'd written for church, and someone recommended that I send them off to Baker's Plays, which is part of Samuel French Company, which is a big play publishing house. And so I sent this collection of sketches up to them, and they loved them and published them. It has a horrible title. It's called Sketches of Harvest, but it was published in, I think, 1981. So now I'm showing my age. I was actually 6 when.
Nice.
You've been with Odyssey pretty much since its inception. Could you elaborate on how you first heard about the show and how you came on staff?
Well, originally, Chuck Bolte, who later became executive producer, was a consultant for Focus on the Family when they started to work on audio dramas. He was friends with some folks who worked on staff, and when they started thinking about doing drama, they called him and said, well, you know, you do drama for a living. Why don't you come in and help us with this? And I was working with Chuck at another ministry, and he came in one day and said, you know, I'm working with this organization called Focus on the Family, and they need writers for an audio drama that they're starting to work on. It's called Family Portraits. Do you know anything about audio drama? Would you like to write for it? And I said, well, I don't know anything about it, but that never stops me from writing for it. So I made the contact with Steve Harris, who was then executive producer. And that pulled me in as a freelancer. I was a freelancer for that program and for Odyssey up until January of 1988. So I didn't come on staff until, I think, 2 months after the show first aired.
Now, you've written and directed hundreds of episodes. Do you feel that your style of writing has changed over the years?
Well, I'd hope so. I mean, there's good news and bad news about that. I think the good news is that a program like Odyssey has given us a lot of creative breadth to explore new ideas, to try different things. The bad news is that our learning curve is out there for everybody to see. So there would be shows that I think I'd look back on now that at the time seemed like a great idea, really innovative and a lot of fun to do. And I look back on it and think, oh, it's like looking at a picture of me wearing bell bottoms. You know, it feels dated, or if I had that to do over again, I'd do it differently. But the truth is, as long as I can say that I've done the very best that I could do at the time I was doing it, then I have no complaints. The audience might, but I don't.
What is your favorite show that you've written and why?
I can't answer that question. I really can't. I mean, with, 200 episodes or whatever, it's really hard because I have great affection for all of the episodes that I was involved in. I mean, I have some affection for certain shows because of the time that they were done or the actors who were involved or the chemistry that went on between the writing and the directing and the actors and the production. If one comes immediately to mind, right now a current favorite, I think, is Best Intentions. I heard it not too long ago, and I was really tickled by it because of the chemistry with the actors in the studio. I mean, it followed right on the heels of the very intense Mortal Coil, and to actually have a fairly lighthearted comedy with all of the characters really being themselves. I really, in retrospect, I really enjoy that episode a lot. It's a current favorite. Ask me in another week, and I'll have another one.
Well, can you answer, who are your favorite Odyssey characters to write dialogue for?
No, that's like asking a parent who's your favorite kid. I mean, you know, I can't answer that question. I love all of the characters and all of the actors who play them. So I can't pick and choose.
Okay, well, maybe Chris can ask a question you can answer.
Yeah, let's try this one. Do you have a least favorite episode or maybe one that you wish you could have a do-over on?
Well, I think the one that comes immediately to mind was the sorry, Nathan is writing down exactly what I was going to say because I think I've probably talked about this before. It was an episode called Hide and Seek, and it's one of those where the creative intentions didn't really play out in the writing. So I went into the studio with something that I thought, well, this should work. I think I can make this work. And I think when all was said and done, it was a good idea that I didn't execute very well.
Lizzie wants to know, according to Focus on the Family's website, your official title is Director of Creative Content. In layman's terms, what does that mean and what does a typical workday look like for you?
Well, the truth is, I think they probably changed that since. I think I'm just a creative director, which sounds like it's a changing around of the words, but it's actually a different meaning. What we have in our content area, which would be books, film, audio, everything we do, we have all these various creative efforts. And as a creative director, I'm sort of a freelancer, but on staff. My boss can assign me to almost any project or anything that we're working on to bring to it whatever he thinks I can bring to it. So it could be Adventures in Odyssey. It can be a film project that we're developing, The Junkyard, for example. It could be Imagination Station chapter books for kids in the publishing realm. It might be an article for one of the magazines. So I'm sort of jumping all over the place these days.
Now, while working for Focus, has your life in any way been changed by writing or working for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, tremendously. The honor of working on a program like Adventures in Odyssey has impacted every aspect of my life. I've actually been involved with Focus longer than I've been married. So Focus has been part of, and I've been married for 21 years. So, I mean, Focus and Adventures in Odyssey and the work that I do here sort of pervades everything that I do. Even if I'm working on projects that aren't related to Focus, somehow it's still part of the whole mix for me creatively and otherwise.
That's great. Now, as we all know, Passages is coming out in only a couple of days, and it's been a long time coming since we've had any new episodes to discuss. I know it's not Album 51, but just how excited are you to finally have new shows hit the airwaves?
It's a mixed blessing in that, because trying to get new shows into the airwaves is its own challenge. I mean, we don't want to just throw anything out there. So our desire for quality, for new creative ideas and new creative approaches is top of the list for us. So one of the reasons we've been a bit slow in getting some new new stuff out there is that we want to get it right. We want to bring the very best that we do out to our audience. So for me, the jump wasn't that big because we did the Truth Chronicles, which feels to me like we just did that yesterday, even though it's been a year and a half ago. And then moving into Darien's Rise and now into Album 51. I mean, I'm glad to keep things going out for our audience because I know how impatient everyone gets. And if they're not getting impatient, then I worry because that means they may be losing interest in us. So, no, I'm really glad to have Darien's Rise out there, and I'm very interested in finding out what everyone thinks of it.
What's the most fascinating aspect of your directing Darien's Rise? And how did it feel to see your book come to life in an audio drama?
Well, it's funny. It's a whole different thing. I wrote Darien's Rise quite a while ago. I mean, it's been a number of years since I wrote it. So the chance to go back and revisit it for audio drama was very intriguing to me, to try to even correct certain things that might have slipped past me when I did the book initially. I think any author enjoys the opportunity to go back and rework things, improve on certain things. And for audio drama, we had to edit, and then even finding those edits, figuring out how to maintain the integrity of the story, but also adhere to something resembling broadcast time, which, as most people know, I'm not very good at that. But with Darien's Rise, it was a great challenge. I really enjoyed working on it.
Follow-up question, sort of. When you originally published the Passages books, they were shorter. When they were re-released, was there content added to them, or was that just my imaginings?
Yeah, what had happened is, it's funny. Our original distributor for those had a very specific page count that they wanted us to adhere to, which this is more than you want to know, but the fact is I had already written two or three of the books before we signed on with this distributor. And suddenly they came in and said, well, they have to be this page length, and you can't go over that. Well, I had already written Glenel's Betrayal, and in that were whole sections that they said, well, you got to find ways to cut this down to a page length that we agree to. So I went through with the publishing team and hacked the living daylights out of it. I mean, there were whole sections in there that we said, well, we'll have to lose this, and one day maybe we'll do a director's cut or something and re-release it. And I never really believed that would happen. It's very rare, you know, unless you're a Tom Clancy or a Stephen King or somebody, you very rarely get a chance to go back and do the author's cut on a book. And so when we decided to re-release them, and we were with a different distributor and had a whole different situation, we said, well, you know, one of the bonuses for people who might want to either rebuy them or being introduced for the first time would be to put some of that material back in. So we did. And I'm really glad that we got to.
I love the names in there. They just, especially in, I just spaced the name of the second one. The one about Noah, except not Noah.
Yeah, Aaron's Judgment.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was the it's funny. I wish I were more like Tolkien or somebody who was more clever with things like names. But when I was working on that one in particular, I don't know, I must have been in a very silly mood. But suddenly the idea of taking water-related words and kind of twisting them around to make names seemed like a very fun idea. So, as you know, Aaron is the word rain. And we have, I mean, if you look at almost all the names in there, except for Tyran, I did that name because it reminded me of Tyrant. And by the way, there's a great history of this. I would point everybody to Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol, because a lot of the words that names he made up for his characters, like Scrooge and Cratchit,
that's true.
All of those names he generally created because of what the sound of the names evoked. He wanted Scrooge because of something that's really screwed up and twisted and turned. And that's what I was trying to do with some of the names for the Passages books.
speaking of names, were there any change because they didn't seem right or because too many people probably wouldn't figure it out?
No, I don't remember there being any that we thought would be confusing. But we are careful. I think in various Odyssey episodes we've had to do that. I don't remember actually in the six passages having to go back and changing. I mean, we changed titles around for various reasons, and we had we were talking about Star Wars not too long ago, and how the original name for Return of the Jedi was Revenge of the Jedi, and then some people came back and said, no, Jedis don't get revenge; they're beyond concepts of revenge, and so they changed it to Return of the Jedi, and I think Glendale's Betrayal and a couple of the other books might have had different titles, where we looked at them and we either thought they were weak or we thought that they were they didn't communicate enough of what the book was going to be. So and Nathan's telling me that actually Glenel's Betrayal was Glenel's Revenge. So clearly there's something about the word revenge that really puts people off.
How do you go about choosing how did you go about choosing the voices for Kyle and Anna, especially considering the casting makes Anna sound older than Kyle?
Well, what we do with all of the casting on any of the Odyssey episodes is we're listening to the voices and we're trying to figure out what do the voices evoke. So, I mean, not only are we hopeful to have an actor or actress who can come in and get the job done, get what we really need them to do, but, you know, all voices evoke something in the listeners' minds. And when we were doing the casting for Darien's Rise, you sometimes play around with how voices will sound together. And we so liked the actors, we thought, well, we'll risk the fact that she sounds older than he does because she's such a great actress and he was so good. And we just thought, well, we'll deal with that and let it play out. But it's funny because in the auditions, I don't think she sounded that much older. So I think something happened in the studio as we were working on it, that the energy of it actually changed the sound of the voices a bit. Which happens.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, just because I noticed once the first episode aired on the official podcast, a lot of people noted on the message boards that Anna did sound older. To me, I really quite enjoyed hearing Rachel and Shane in those roles, because I thought, hey, what better way to use characters we've already heard than to use them in passages? Even, I mean, in the same way that the original kids from Fletcher's Rebellion were Odyssey kid characters, and then they were used to play Timmy and Alice. I thought that was great.
Right. Right. Though Fletcher's, I mean, the funny thing about Fletcher's, because it's not based on one of the novels, was that I decided to cross the line. When the books first came out, the publishing house really wanted us to do something to help advertise the books, which makes perfect sense. And they said, why don't you do episodes? And I thought, well, I don't want to do an episode based on the books themselves, because we were going to do it in two parts or something. So Fletcher's Rebellion came out of a desire to tell a different story, but then to cross the line into the real world of Odyssey, because remember, the kids went over to Maris, but because of the woman telling Tom Riley the story, it suddenly brought everything back to Odyssey again, which I thought was a fun difference from between Fletcher's Rebellion and the books.
Now, just going back to Darien's Rise for a minute, what was it like working with Jim Cummings?
Jim Cummings was fantastic. In fact, every now and again, we'll work on a project, whether it's Odyssey or radio theater, where you come out of the studio and one of the actors sort of, I don't know, brings so much to the role that we almost want to give them some sort of an award. And a lot of times it's not even a major character. It can be a secondary character. But whatever it is that the actor brings in to the studio generates a whole energy and dynamic that you love to have when you're in the studio. And Jim Cummings was like that. He walked through the door. He already had a good sense of Lawrence and what Lawrence should be. He and I talked about it a little bit before we recorded, but he needed very little direction. He more or less stepped in, and every scene he did, he hit exactly as it needed to be hit, and brought so much passion to it. I mean, when you hear it, it's amazing what he did with that.
I loved how when he was, at least in the first part, when he was speaking, I could hear little bits of Tigger in him every now and again. And then I heard a little bit of Pete, and then it was a different voice altogether. And I was like, whoa, that's so cool. I don't know. It made me happy.
Yeah. Oh, and he's amazing. He's an amazing actor.
One of the, actually the most popular questions we received was whether or not you'd be turning the remaining five Passages books into audio dramas. Do you guys currently have plans for doing future adaptations for the remaining five books?
Well, to put it crudely, it really depends on how this one does. We can only justify doing more if this one does well enough to warrant it. I mean, we don't often do that. Sometimes we'll sort of recklessly move ahead and just do a whole bunch of things, whether anybody acts like they want them, wants them or not. But for this, we said, well, we're not going to commit to doing the other five until we see that people were really interested in this first one. And if there's a big interest in it, then we'll go on to the next one and then the next one, and we'll see if we can get them all done. I would love to do all five, or all six, I should say. Part of me would love to redo Fletcher's Rebellion if I could, but yeah, it depends on you guys, really.
Yeah, this isn't Lord of the Rings here. You're not doing all of them at once and hoping, crossing your fingers, hoping that it sells. But
yeah, by the way, we don't cross our fingers here. We don't
endorse the crossing of fingers.
How much research went into writing the Passages series? Did you select certain Bible stories because they were personal favorites, or was it a matter of finding stories that would work well with in the context of Maris?
Both, really. I mean, obviously, we were looking for the stories out of the Old Testament that we thought would tell best, that are solid stories. So I had to look at the narrative of each one to see if it would retell in the context of Maris well. Because there were some stories we considered that I thought, well, I don't know that it's going to fit very well in this world. So put those aside and just went for the ones that seemed the strongest. So and the research was mostly biblical. I mean, anytime you're taking a biblical story and you're translating it to anything else, I mean, even just an audio drama like Odyssey, where we're just doing a straight retelling, you still have to make a lot of choices about the characters and who they are, about how they communicate, how they talk. All of those things are key parts of how we adapt anything from one form to another. And that was true here, because to adapt from the biblical story to the Passages novel was one step of the process. Then to take the novel itself and turn it into an audio drama required a whole other discipline. So there was a bit of research in that, because I didn't want to misrepresent or put any errors into the retelling of the biblical stories. Though I did take some dramatic license with two or three things, embellished certain things and did certain things, played up some even obscure things that I didn't realize were there until I really studied the story, and then certain things emerged that I had never noticed before.
Now, in writing the books, were any of the kid characters like Kyle, Anna, Wade, were they based on people you know in real life, or were they more based on their role in the biblical story?
The characters from Odyssey, I mean, everything, this is hard to answer in a way, because I think any writer is absorbing. Writers are leeches, okay? Let me be clear about that. There is no human being that we ever meet, no situation we encounter, no matter how good or bad, that there isn't part of us somewhere in our brains where we're taking notes. We're always taking notes. We're taking our reality and filtering it through our writing. That's just the way we do it. So I don't think I directly connected any of the kid characters in Passages to somebody I knew, and yet they are a distillation of well, pretty much kids I've met, some attributes of my own. So I don't know if that answers your question fairly, but there's not a direct relationship, but you can be sure that their characteristics have come from somewhere or somebody that I've met.
Gotcha.
Were there any ideas for Passages that you didn't use or might be willing to use for possible future books?
I would. I think, I mean, there are lots of stories that we haven't told. I haven't. It's funny, once a project's done, I mean, once I hit the sixth book and even sort of the punctuation mark at the end of that, I tend to put projects out of my mind because I'm then moving on to the next project. So to be honest, I haven't, until somebody comes back to me and says, we are going to do, you know, another three books, or we're going to do more audio dramas that aren't in the books, I tend not to spend a lot of time thinking about it. But at the point when somebody does that, then I'll definitely go back to my notes. I have a file full of notes on every project I do that probably have, it probably has as many ideas that I don't use as ideas that I do.
Wow. Now, you've been involved in a variety of other audio dramas, from Christmas Carol, Bonhoeffer, Amazing Grace, and one of my personal favorites, Father Gilbert. Honestly, I still get chills every time I listen to Dead Air. That one gets me every time. Where did the inspiration for those mysteries come from?
With Father Gilbert, by the way, I should say that you know, we've sort of wrapped up the package. I mean, we have a big package now of all the mysteries. But there is sort of a sequel to it because I'm now under contract to write two Father Gilbert novels, which I'm going to do. I'm actually starting on the first one here in the next couple of weeks. So Father Gilbert is alive and well. And some people don't know that Father Gilbert also puts in an appearance in another book I wrote called The Mill House.
Yes,
and he's
I remember that.
And the whole thing takes place around Stonebridge, but it's not centered around Father Gilbert, so it's like he's there, but a lot of people don't realize that he's the Father Gilbert from the mystery series. But with Father Gilbert, I'll tell you honestly, I started with an idea before I came to the characters. One of the goals of radio theater was to create secular-worthy stories, but from a Christian worldview. And I was honestly wrestling through, how do we do that? And, I mean, we can do all these adaptations of Les Mis and Narnia and all the classics, but what's the new way of doing that? And I was just suddenly struck by this idea of what if a man who worked for Scotland Yard became an Anglican priest? And I'll tell you honestly, the reason I chose making him an Anglican priest, Church of England priest there, was because in the secular world, in a world outside of the evangelical world in which we exist, priests have a lot of credibility as characters. That's why you more often than not find Catholic, Anglican, somebody wearing an identifiable uniform, a collar or something, as spiritual advisors in you know, secular movies and TV shows, that sort of thing. You rarely see, you know, Baptist preachers or other types who just wear suits and look like everybody else. And I think it's because it's ingrained in people's thinking that there's something different about these people. They dress different, and maybe they know something we don't know. So I purposely went with an Anglican priest because I honestly thought that would be more acceptable to Protestants. And since most of our listeners are Protestants, I didn't want to offend them. And most, I don't think most American Protestants even know what an Anglican is. I think they think it has something to do with fly fishing. But, you know, but it's a pastor in the Church of England. So by doing all of that and creating this character and the situations for him, it allowed me to play with ideas that I didn't think would be as offensive as it might be if I'd made him an American priest or an American pastor, because then you're dealing with the denominations, you're dealing with a lot of things that suddenly people are going to be making judgments about him based on their own experiences. Whereas if I put it into a foreign country and make him something they don't necessarily know much about, then I have a fighting chance of exploring ideas I really wanted to explore. That was a very long-winded answer, and I apologize.
It's okay. Nothing editing can't fix. I was
thank you.
I was looking over the list of projects you'd worked on, and I completely forgot that you had actually worked with extensively with on the Narnia series. And I personally loved how you guys just brought everything to life with, you know, the acting, sound design, script. And for me, it was far superior to the Narnia films. Now, maybe that's an unfair comparison just because it's radio versus screenplay, because you can use your imagination when you're listening to it. My question, though, is what was the thought process that went into writing the scripts? Like, for the most part, the Narnia drama is fairly consistent with the books. So were there any challenges in writing it for radio, or was the adaptation... or the adaptation fairly straightforward?
Well, there are always challenges. As I said earlier, anytime you're adapting from one thing to another, there are going to be huge challenges. But some of them are the assumptions when we went in on it. My assumption, and I think the team's assumption, was that we were going to stay true to the books and to the spirit of what Lewis had brought to them, that it wasn't our job. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be able to dramatize these books. And our job was to figure out how to best represent Lewis, not suddenly get playfully creative and pretend like we are Lewis. So from the beginning, there was no question in my mind that we were going to stay true to the books. Now, the challenges are, how do you stay true to the books and adapt for audio drama? And so there were basic rules that I followed. I always tried to make sure to dramatize what I believed could be dramatized, that the audience would get in their imaginations, and only narrate those things that I knew the audience would have trouble picturing in their minds without help from a narrator. I generally don't like to use narrators. And by the way, Philip Glassboro, who worked with us very closely on all of those and did our casting and production and stuff, from the very beginning said, you don't call him a narrator, he's a storyteller. And it was that that allowed us to work with somebody like Paul Scofield, who was a brilliant actor. He took it because he was going to be a storyteller rather than just a narrator filling in the missing pieces. So even in that, we were trying to stay true to Lewis's voice in the narrative. It wasn't supposed to be my voice or our voice. It was always supposed to be Lewis. So that was driving us behind the scenes on that, was to stay true to Lewis, but to create, to the best of our ability, a great audio drama experience. And I think after 5 or 6 years, whatever amount of time we spent on it, and the hundreds of actors that we worked with, I think we pulled it off. At least I hope we did.
So speaking of Lewis, C.S. Lewis has been mentioned many times in Odyssey and Narnia and the Screwtape Letters coming out soon. And the passage's concept is similar to that of the Chronicles of Narnia. What is it about Lewis's writing that interests you and the AIO team so much, and how has it influenced your writing?
Well, C.S. Lewis was a remarkable man and was a huge influence on, I know, Phil Lawler, on me, in a lot of different ways. I mean, you read him and he can be very inspiring and can lead you to want to create in a way like he does. Now, I've always been fascinated, even before I was ever introduced to C.S. Lewis's writings. I've always loved time travel. I've always loved displacing individuals from one world to another. And yet, for a long time, I wouldn't read somebody like Tolkien because it was so otherworldly that I wasn't sure I could engage in it. I've since read the books and now see why anybody who ever writes fantasy owes everything to Tolkien, even Lewis, in fact. For me, it's Lewis explored that whole idea of, you know, moving modern kids from his time to, you know, this other world. Well, for me, it was a similar thing, though I wouldn't call it an allegory. All I did was take the biblical narratives and place them in another world. Lewis didn't do that. Lewis has a lot of biblical allusion in his work, but it's not allegorical, and it's not a one-to-one relationship between Narnia and the biblical story. It's like a flavoring more than it is a retelling.
How did the idea to adapt Screwtape Letters for radio first come about?
Well, in our wish list when we started radio theater, I think Screwtape Letters was on the list from the beginning. I think we would love to dramatize all of C.S. Lewis's stories because there's The Great Divorce, there's the science fiction trilogy. There are others we'd love to do. But the opportunity came up with Screwtape, and we grabbed at it. I didn't realize what I was getting into, though, because suddenly I realized that it's one thing to kind of want to dramatize it. It's another thing to actually have to do it. So then came the process of trying to figure out how you take a series of letters and actually bring a semblance of drama to them. And that took me a little while to figure out, but I think we got there.
Now, in doing the Screwtape Letters, you got the opportunity to work with Andy Serkis, and I know myself, I was thrilled when I heard that he would be voicing Screwtape, is it?
Yeah, he's Screwtape.
What was it like working with him?
Andy he's an incredible individual, and you just watch his work as Gollum, and you watch him in different films, and he just brings so much energy and passion to what he does. And a lot of times when we audition actors or we bring actors in, you know exactly what you're going to get from them because of their work. So there wouldn't necessarily be any real surprises. With Andy, one of the reasons we went with him was the sense that we thought he'll get what we need him to do, but we think he's going to surprise us. He's going to come in and bring something to the role that will be fun and unexpected. And he did that. Absolutely. He came in and was absolutely committed to the role. It's a tough job. I mean, to take these sentences the way Lewis had constructed them, which I was trying to honor. Again, I wasn't trying to rewrite Lewis. I was trying to represent him as well as I could in drama. And Andy came in and not only had to navigate through the sentences so that they would make sense to the audience, but he did it as a performance. It's not a book on tape. So for him to perform that role was, he said, as draining as anything he's ever done, including playing Gollum for 5 years, which I found hard to believe. But he said he was going home every day absolutely shattered. I mean, he was just exhausted.
Do you have any plans any more radio theater projects?
Well, we always have plans. It's just a matter of getting the budget and getting the resources to do them. So, I mean, we would love to do, as I said, more C.S. Lewis stories. I'd love to do more Father Gilbert's. I've outlined a few that we haven't gotten to yet. I mean, there's always a list somewhere of things that we would love to do if we could get the means to do them.
All right. Just going back to Odyssey now, this was another one of our more popular questions. How did you get drafted to be one of the most notorious bad guys in Odyssey history, and will he be making a return?
I'm getting fuzzy about this. As the years go by, I think I'm beginning to change the story. But my memory is that playing Glossman, I mean, was certainly not my idea, because I really, for as much as I talk, I don't really like the sound of my voice. And I'm no actor, and I don't pretend to be an actor. So I think Phil Lawler and Chuck Bolte may have corralled me into doing it. And I think I naively did the role of Glossman initially, thinking I was just laying down some basic tracks, that it was a one-off part, that I'll lay down the tracks and they'll get somebody better to do them later, you know. And then they never did. And and then suddenly Glossman played a role in something else. And then they had me over a barrel, because then they said, well, you played him before, you've got to play him now. And suddenly
was that intentional?
I think there was something vindictive on the part of to get me into something that could, I mean, I'm just not comfortable doing that sort of thing.
Oh.
So when I was given the chance, I wrote him out as quickly as I could. And he's made a couple of appearances, obligatory for various reasons. And he's in album 50, which was my idea, but he's in very briefly. And you hear him very quickly on
Crime Brian Byrne show.
Yeah. And I thought, well, that would be okay, because album 50 sort of evokes all of the albums, and you know, there are little hints of other characters we haven't heard from in a long time. There are hints of plot lines and things that we sort of reference. And I thought, well, okay, I'll bite the bullet on this. I'll go ahead and do Glossman one more time. But I don't have any real intention of Glossman ever coming back again. I mean, I don't like him. Do you guys like him? I don't like him. I don't like being associated with
him. He's the slimy character that you don't really like, but you love to hate. So,
okay. All right. That's fine. I just have a real problem, because I met one of our listeners, you know, this 9-year-old boy who I did not say I was Glossman. And he looked at me and he just said, I don't like you. And I wanted to say, it's not me, really, honest.
That's awesome. That's great.
Well, okay, so we can assume that Philip Glossman is not coming back, but can we expect you to be back writing full-time for Odyssey in 2010 and onwards?
Well, I'm right now I'm completely dedicated. I mean, we're doing album 51. I'm involved in all the scripts for that. And until somebody gives me another assignment, I mean, which is always my boss's choice, I'm with Odyssey. And so until somebody tells me otherwise, I'm working on the scripts and working with the script writers and the team and enjoying it. It's like starting over in a lot of ways. So unless somebody gives me another job, I'm here.
All right. So this new passage is a drama features the premiere of a third voice actor portraying Wit. Presumably to continue in album 51. What discussions went on behind the scenes about whether to keep or lose Wit? And after producing roughly 300 hours of Odyssey dramas with Wit, did the Odyssey team consider doing something drastic?
Well, the Odyssey team is always considering doing something drastic. I mean, we're all at heart dramatists, and we will always have the discussion of what will we do that will really shake things up and be as dramatic as it could possibly be. So when we're having brainstorms about the show, you can be sure that there will always be some component that would absolutely shock people if they could sit in and hear what we're talking about. But I will say for me, I would never, ever consider losing Wit from the show. I mean, to me, Wit is the center and the heart of what the show is. Even if he's not in every episode, he sort of pervades what Odyssey is in the way that Aslan pervades Narnia. I mean, to me, it's I can't imagine separating the show from Wit. So finding a new actor, a voice to represent Wit was a priority to me. We now have access to actors that after Hal Smith died, we didn't have access to a lot of actors. So it really narrowed down our choices. Now we actually have access to more, and so we were able to audition a variety of voices, a variety of actors, to really think through who best captures the heart and soul of that character. And we landed with Andre. In fact, if you listen to the Truth Chronicles, you'll hear Andre's in there, because we wanted to get him into the studio ahead of even talking to him about Wit. Because we wanted to see what it would be like to work with him. He's in the Stepping Stones episodes.
Yeah.
So he's there.
I remember that. Okay.
But I think we tried to direct him away from sounding like Wit because we didn't want to necessarily betray what we were thinking. But Andre's a great guy, wonderful to work with in the studio. And it's funny because he really is a third. I mean, you can hear a bit of Hal Smith in him. You can hear some of what Paul did. It's like a blending of the two without our intentionally doing that. We're just not that clever. So he is who he is, and he will bring what he brings to the role. I'm just looking forward to working with him more on the show.
On the dramatic thing and never losing Wit, did you guys ever decide if you were going to mention Tom Riley anymore, or is it like, is she just gone? Is that going to be touched on at all?
We're holding on with Tom. We don't want to commit one way or the other to the future of the character. So as is often the case with Odyssey, if long-term listeners will know that, what we'll do, it's almost like a trick of the camera, you know, which is funny to say that for an audio drama. But, you know, it's like anything. If you're watching something, if the camera moves off to the side and focuses on three characters over to the side, then that means there might be one or two characters that the camera's not on. And we've done that over the years with Odyssey. Our story might shift over to some characters that it doesn't mean that the characters you've been hearing have left Odyssey. It's not like a formal leaving. The stories just don't emphasize those characters. And I think we're going to do the same with Tom for a bit until we can think through the future of the character and what we ought to do with him. So he just won't be a focus of attention. We're not saying he's gone. We're not saying he's around. He's just not part of the stories right now.
One more quick question. Are you planning on using Dave Madden anymore, or is he kind of done for now.
You know, I've always hated working with Dave Madden. You know, he is just a terror in the studio. He is it's all about him. And I just thought, as soon as I can get rid of this guy, you know, I hope you guys aren't believing a word I'm saying, because your silence scares me. Dave, I mean, as with some of our actors, Dave no longer lives in the Los Angeles area. He's now on the opposite end of the country. And we love working with Dave and would work with Dave again. We're not making any definitive statements about Bernard, about whether he reappears or he doesn't reappear. We've not written him out, as in he's packed up the truck and moved to Beverly. Sorry, that's an old allusion to the Beverly Hillbillies for anyone out there over the age of 10. No, we would love to work with Dave again as we have opportunity to, but with him being on the opposite side of the country and basically retired, what a lot of people don't realize is, I mean, he retired quite a while ago, but he has consistently come out of retirement to work with us because he appears to like working with us. And any chance we have to work with him, we'll grab.
That's great. Now, just going back quickly to The Third Wit, what were some episodes or scenes you used for auditioning Andre? And also, were there any specific episodes you recommended he listen to?
Yeah, the clips that we gave him to work from, Flash Flood was one, because we wanted to hear him doing Wit in sort of an action mode. And then I think we chose one that had him interacting with Connie, because we wanted to hear that chemistry. We wanted to hear the chemistry between Andre and Katie, who plays Connie. And then we also did a clip from the one about trust, which was with the kid, so that we could hear. Sorry. That was the one with Connie. It was the one about trust, was with Connie. Prodigal Jimmy was the one, so we could hear Wit interacting with one of the kid actors. Just see what the chemistry was, to see how he would sound in what we consider probably the three most common things that we'll see Wit do, which is he's either interacting with Connie and Eugene or with the kids, with Wooten, of course, but we didn't actually choose one of those because, I mean, it's up for grabs anytime you get Wooten in the studio, so there's no auditioning anybody against Wooten. He sounded great in all the things we had him read.
Awesome. Okay. Last question. We made it. Woohoo! Is there anything new about season 51 that you'd be willing to let slip?
Let slip? Well, we're actually, I don't know that there are huge secrets. I mean, we're introducing a couple of new families, the Parker family and the Jones family, and they're very specific characters. We just listened to one of the first episodes that really introduces the Parkers. And very unique, very different, very fun. And we're also trying to drive the stories back to very slice of life stories that I think most of our fans will relate to. Family experiences and school experiences that are ring true to them and will have meaning for them. So those aren't big secrets, but there are one or two surprises, I think, that'll come out that are fun surprises. We don't have any traumatic or really big dramatic moments. I mean, Blackert doesn't reappear or anything like that. But there is a theme, there seems to be a theme in this album that emerged over time that was unintentional, and there seem to be a lot of animals in this. For some reason, I'm not even sure.
Oh, I'm sure the sound designers love that.
Yeah, well, we didn't bring in any dogs. You know, they really, it's very hard for them to work with dogs. But the animals we brought in.
So elephants are no problem, but no dogs, huh?
Well, because they're much more easily trained, and they work better in the studio because they work for peanuts, in fact. But we've got an animal thing going on, and I'm not sure why that is. But everyone has theories about something subconsciously happening with the team.
Are we going to hear from anybody from before this album other than Wit, Connie, Eugene, and Wooten? Like, is anybody else coming back? Or is it pretty much scrapped?
Scrapped is the wrong way to put it, because like I said about Bernard and about Tom and other characters, the fact that they may not feature in the story doesn't mean that they're gone. I mean, we have 12 episodes to work with, in each album, and there's only so many characters you can have in each one. So, the main emphasis has been on introducing the new families. Whit, Connie, Wooten, and Eugene are certainly part of these stories. That's it for now, but I'm not discounting the possibility of album 52 having some characters in that we know from the past.
Okay. What about Whit's End Connellsville?
Whit's End Connellsville, that's a really good question. And maybe we'll answer that question in album 52 as well.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, that's all the questions we have for you, Paul. Thank you very much for your time and for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks. Those are good questions. Thank you. And thank you, Skype, for being so reliable as you often are.